Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. This is a Saturday special. Some of you listening right now may be looking forward to watching a lot of college basketball in the next few days as the March Madness tournament for both the men and women will be entering into the Sweet 16 round tomorrow. But off the court, you may have heard about a different kind of madness, the disparity in resources that the NCAA, the organization in charge of college sports and including the March Madness tournament, has provided for the competing male and female basketball teams this year. With me now to catch us up on what was revealed in the last week, as well as talk about her own experiences covering women in sports over her career, is Sally Jenkins, sports columnist for The Washington Post and formerly a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Hi, Sally. Thanks for your time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Glad to be here.
So last week, for people who haven't heard this story, videos posted by female players competing in this year's March Madness brought to light some of the differences between the male and female bubbles, COVID bubbles, where the athletes are competing, the men in Indianapolis and the women in San Antonio. So, Sally, help listeners who aren't as familiar with the story understand it. What was revealed last week?
Well, what was revealed was a pretty pervasive disparity in terms of the basic promotion of the women's event. Literally, the floors that the women are playing on look inferior and are inferior. The testing for COVID is different. The men are getting a more expensive and more reliable PCR testing, whereas the women have been getting antigen testing, and also the circumstances under which they're tested are different. I talked to a woman's coach who had to walk her team 3/4 of a mile to the testing site after a ball game at 9 o'clock at night. I'm pretty sure Gonzaga men aren't having to do that at their tournament, you know? So it's a range of differences.
For people who don't know, that's a top-rated team, so they're treated as stars, the Gonzaga men's team players, right?
Correct. And, you know, I just don't think a men's coach is worried about, you know, his players' legs at 9 o'clock at night, walking 3/4 of a mile to get COVID tested. So, you know, so it's a range of issues, and it's chronic, it's pervasive. The coaches in the women's game will tell you that they simply have really struggled with the NCAA in resources, in promotions, in marketing. It's a range of from the petty, issue of the weight room at the women's tournament was really, really deficient. You know, it was a stack of yoga mats and about 6 weights for 64 teams for a month. And then if you look at the men's weight room in Indianapolis, it was really this gigantic palatial acreage full of state-of-the-art equipment, you know, things like that. You could go on and on. There's a long list of them.
Yeah, the weight room disparities made for some stark television viewing last week, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Is this even legal? I mean, when you're getting to the point of not just disparities in the kind of weight room equipment and infrastructure that's available, but what you described, worse COVID tests during the pandemic. Title IX, as we all know, is the 1972 law that says no person in the United States shall be discriminated against on the basis of sex in any education program receiving federal financial assistance. Even on the NCAA's own website, there's a statement that reaffirms how Title IX requires the equal treatment of female and male student athletes in equipment and supplies, medical and training facilities and services, and housing and dining facilities and services, to name a few. Do these incidents that we're discussing sound like a Title IX violation?
Well, certainly, but here's the funny thing. The NCAA itself is not bound by Title IX. Only the individual institutions are. The NCAA is actually not defined as a state actor. Because it's basically a coalition of the individuals, you know, 1,000 and some schools. So legally, the NCAA can do whatever it wants, to be pointed about it.
Wow.
Now, they say that they voluntarily want to comply with Title IX standards just like their individual institutions do, but in this case, they haven't.
listeners, we're going to open up the phones in a minute, but first we're going to play a clip of University of South Carolina women's basketball coach Dawn Staley last Friday.
We're under the umbrella of March Madness. If the NCAA owns March Madness and all of, you know, is luxury, then it should feel luxurious to every student athlete, man or woman. So, no, we shouldn't be happy with just getting the bare minimum. No, we should not be happy with being, you know, second class citizens when it comes to our student athletes. You know, are we grateful that we got a tournament off? Yes. But, you know, if the men got a tournament off and they're rolling out the red carpet for them, then that's our expectation.
Fair enough. University of South Carolina women's basketball coach. Sally, the NCAA, as you know, has argued in the past that the reason the men's game and men's sports in general receive more attention and particularly resources is because it's just more popular and makes more money than the women's game. How would you respond to that?
The men will command about 10 million viewers probably for their championship game. The women will command somewhere between 3.5 and 4. That's a big difference. The men's contract with CBS is a $19 billion contract over 22 years. The women have a contract with ESPN for about $500 million. You know, so again, big difference in revenue. But what I would point out is that one reason why the NCAA is not held to Title IX is because it's not a state actor. It's defined as an educational nonprofit under the law. Its aim is to break even. And all of the revenue from all of these income-producing championships, whether it's the women's basketball tournament, the men's basketball tournament, the women's college softball World Series, the men's baseball World Series, all of that revenue from those events goes into a single pot. And the NCAA itself then decides how to disperse that money. They've been dispersing it very, very, very unequally and in a way that is actually very, very hard to sort out. They blend the revenues, and they can tell any kind of story they want to with their bookkeeping. And that's one of the things that has come up in the name, image, and likeness cases that are, for one thing, before the Supreme Court right now. So there's a big tangle of revenue. There's a big tangle of allocations. And so the question becomes, you know, why is the NCAA defining women as a, quote, cost? You know, women's basketball is not a cost. Women's basketball is the point. There's 90 championships in the NCAA, and they're all the point of the organization. No one should be defined as a cost or more of a profit-making enterprise. This is supposed to be an educational nonprofit that's supposed to be maximizing opportunities for as many kids as possible.
Mia in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. And Mia, thanks so much for calling in.
Great. Thank you so much for taking my call. I listen to your show all the time. I was at Yale in 1970s on the crew team, and we had two women who were going to become Olympians. We were forced, Yale said they did not have the money to give us a decent, we were on the crew team, and we did not have the money. They said that they didn't have the money to give us boats that were not broken, gyms where we could work out. We were second in the country. The men were 55th. And we were forced to wait on buses in February after working out, where we were freezing and getting upper respiratory infections while they had more showers than men. We would wait 40 minutes on the bus. We staged something called, you know, we were the Yale 19. We took off our clothes, wrote Title IX on our bodies, and the New York Times was there, reported it. The next day we had all three networks there. And miraculously, Yale found the money to get us trailer hookups with showers. Senator John Kerry called us the Rosa Parks of Title IX, and I cannot believe, but as I hear the story, that this is still happening. You know, just the fact that Me Too happened, I never thought that would happen in my lifetime as a 65-year-old former athlete, but that was 1975, and I just cannot believe this is still happening. And I'm so glad that women are speaking out in the NCAA.
Thank you for speaking out, Mia. Let's go right to Karen in Rose Hill. Karen, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you. My question is, who are the members on the NCAA making these decisions? The statement was that they're representatives of the colleges. How do they get into that position?
Sally?
So NCAA representatives come from various schools, and there are a gazillion committees. If you look at the NCAA website, there's a basketball oversight committee for men. There's a basketball oversight committee for women. One of the things you'll notice is that the basketball oversight committee for men is made up of very powerful athletic directors from the most prominent, powerful college basketball and football schools in the country, you know, major public universities. It's interesting because the women's basketball oversight committee tends to be not as powerful. The representatives on that committee, for one thing, historically have not been as powerful. They don't come from schools that are as prominent. And so, you know, one of the things that we're learning is that there's been some real sort of segregation within the NCAA. These oversight committees do not communicate very well. They don't work very well together. There's some dysfunction within the organization. And that's why, like, you know, some of the people in the NCAA were not even aware of the conditions at the women's basketball tournament in San Antonio because they simply weren't paying attention. You know, so, and then there's another structure within the NCAA, which is the ongoing administration, which is Mark Emmert, the president, who's a hired salaried employee, and he has an entire staff. And apparently his staff was totally asleep at the switch as well. So, you know, my question has been, and what I've been writing in the Washington Post all week is, you know, is this malpractice or malfeasance, or is it just indifference? And it's a blend of all three, I think. There is just no motivation at the NCAA to do right by women's programs because of the huge CBS billion-dollar contract that has that organization swimming so much in cash that it doesn't have to care about the women's tournament. And it's created a real mentality of, well, they're smaller. They're not as worthy.
And beyond the responsibility of the NCAA leadership, which you described so clearly before, is not accountable in the same way as the universities themselves are under Title IX, there are the athletic directors of the individual universities. And in one of your pieces, you wrote about some numbers, including that women make up 44% of all NCAA athletes, yet among the 65 schools in the Power Five conferences, meaning the Big Ten, Big 12, ACC, SEC, and Pac-12, there are only four female athletic directors. So can you explain to our listeners what the role of an athletic director is and how they can influence the current inequalities?
So an athletic director oversees, you know, all of the sports at a university. There's usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30 to some schools have even as many as 35 sports. So at a Stanford or an Ohio State or a Michigan, the athletic director oversees the operating budgets of all of those programs, which amount to the hundreds of millions of dollars. The University of Texas has a, you know, truly massive budget in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And the funny thing about all of this is, you know, the biggest cost at all of these schools, it's not women's basketball. It's not even, you know, the $5 or $6 million coaching salary for the football coach or the basketball coach. The biggest expense, the biggest drain, and the biggest cost burden in this whole deal is, in fact, the salaries of non-coaching associate assistant athletic directors. The bloat, the staffing bloat, and the waste in overstaffing is the real drain in this entire thing. You know, and so the NCAA really has some nerve to say that the women somehow don't produce enough revenue and cost too much money.
Nicole in West Cornwall, Connecticut. You're on WNYC with Sally Jenkins from the Washington Post. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, thank you. Well, I'm calling because when I grew up in Connecticut, I live in New York City, and UConn women's basketball, like, they were amazing. They shaped me. I have, like, Shea Ralph and Rebecca Lobo and Cheryl Swoops were just incredible. And I think as, like, a young queer person growing up, that was incredibly important to see. But I'm mainly calling because I also was a former coach for girls lacrosse. So I'm, like, really big on, like, sports for girls. But there are actually three bills going through right now, Arkansas, South Dakota, and Alabama, that are trying to ban trans girls and trans women from playing in sports. And this is huge under like Title IX, under access. And the fact that they're specifically targeting girls and women in this, I think just goes into the larger conversation of the way that women's sports and girls' sports are highly regulated and who gets to participate and who doesn't. And to be real, like women's basketball, there's a lot of queer women in there. It always has been. It's a thing. And you kind of, like, I think as a young queer person growing up, like seeing women play sports gives this ability of an expansion of gender, an expansion of body, an expansion of being able to do things. And these bills are super harmful. And so I just wanted to bring that up in part of the conversation because it just goes along with, you know, who has access and who doesn't mm-hmm. and how those things are regulated.
Nicole, so what would you say to the people on the other side of this issue who argue that when you're talking about trans girls and trans women, they are people born with male bodies, they're likely to be bigger and stronger on average, and so might have an unfair advantage in the sport?
Well, I think what I would say is that you know, biological sex does not determine gender. And also, I think something that we've seen from women's sports is that this idea, concept of genitals, of biology, doesn't determine the strength of someone, right? So it's really about how they feel in their body and what they do with their body. So there are plenty of people with different, you know, bodies, like women bodies or however they are, that can perform. I mean, if we look back at Billie Jean King, she beat out him, right? And so there was this concept that, like, you know, women bodies were not as strong as men, and that kind of goes out the window if we think about outside of biology, but really about just gender and expression, how people are. And I think there's such a powerful space in terms of girls and women's sports for people who are identifying within that group to feel like powerful and to understand. And there's something really special about these spaces that go beyond just the biology of things, that go more into the concept of connection and togetherness and teamwork and working for each other. And so people who are like, you know, they'll be too strong or they'll be this. Well, there's lots of different bodies with lots of different genitals that have different strengths and abilities. Mm-hmm. And it's not.
Let me get a thought from Sally before we run out of time in the show. Nicole, thank you so much for your call. Sally, I'm sure you've thought about this issue. Where are you on this?
I don't know. You know, I it's a very, very complex issue. And the problem that I have in any of these discussions is I think we don't have enough research yet. You know, the USOC and the International Olympic Committee go back and forth and back and forth. There's, I mean, raging arguments between scientists on this. There's one group of people that argues very much as Nicole just did. You know, it's difficult to see how transgender could be an advantage, like in terms of a biological advantage. On the other hand, there is, you know, certainly some concern that testosterone, for instance, might lead to big, you know, people with bigger hands, bigger feet, longer thigh bones. All of these things could conceivably create a competitive advantage physically, but I don't know enough about this yet, quite honestly. You know, we've had a raging controversy for decades about whether sport in general should be sex segregated, you know, along male and female. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very complicated subject that requires thoughtfulness. And to politicize it before we have all the science in, before we've really even started to, I mean, we've done the same thing, by the way, with so-called sports doping. You know, we rush into judgments about these actually difficult scientific issues without all the information in. This is a nascent new subject, and I think we need to really, really take a hard look at it before we come to hard and fast conclusions here.
All right. In our last minute, for a little bit of fun, as the tournament resumes this weekend, want to give our listeners a quick scouting report on any women's teams or players that they might want to look for as especially interesting this weekend?
Listen, don't miss UConn-Iowa. It's the two greatest individual players in the women's game, the two best scorers, Paige Beckers for UConn against Caitlin Clark for Iowa, the two candidates, two leading candidates for Player of the Year. They play the game like threads of silk. I mean, they can really shoot the ball. They can really move. It's going to be on ABC on Saturday afternoon, and don't miss it.
They play the game like threads of silk. That's why Sally Jenkins is a sports columnist for the Washington Post. Some of you may know her previous work for Sports Illustrated. Sally, enjoy the games. Thank you so much for clarity on the issues and for taking calls with us. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.